യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദികേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാർന്നതോസ്മി. സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാദ്വിവരണസ്യ ച. Most of you may be familiar with this verse, but frequently when there is an interval, I try to explain this. It is an invocation to the great Patanjali, the sage who wrote this Yoga Sutra, which is the Bible of Yoga tradition, around 1800 BC. So that's the invocation. So now coming to the text, as we have been discussing, I think I was reading one very interesting description of Swami Vivekananda from the complete works. That's what we're doing. That the sutra we discussed in the last session was this: etayeva savichara nirvichara cha sukshma vishaya vyakhyata. See, it's the 44th sutra of Samadhipada. So what this sutra says is simple. The savichara, nirvichara, these are all two types of samadhi. So samapatti is used here. Or savitarka, nirvitarka. So they are different only on the basis of the object of meditation. So that is the simple principle. Now I will continue the discussion where we left last time. You may remember the sutra we discussed in the last session was this: Surupa Shunya Sadi Artha Nirbhasa Nirvitarka. This is the definition. So that is the when the human memory gets purified, free of all vikalpa, speculations or questions or disturbances, then the chitta remains as if it has lost its true nature. Then what happens? Only the object, the dhyaya vastu, what is called the object of meditation, alone remains. This is the meaning of the sutra we already discussed. Now what happens at this stage, this 43rd sutra? What happens? For that we should know the previous sutra, the earlier sutra. Tatra shabdartha jnana vikalpeki sankirna savitarka samapattihi. So we already discussed sound, meaning and resulting knowledge. Sound means vibration. Meaning means nerve currents which conduct it, and knowledge of reaction. All these remain intact. But when you reach this higher samadhi, which is called nirvitarka, then the memory gets completely purified. And what happens? It loses its essential properties. Mind loses those properties, those characteristics which constitute the mind. So this should be understood in a very interesting context. What is mind? Mind is, by its very nature, a changing, changeable phenomenon. A number of thought currents, ideas and impressions come in a flow without any harmony, with a lot of friction. It is called mind. So mind as understood in the yoga tradition is not an entity. It is the name of a particular phenomenon created by impressions and thought currents. These impressions and thought currents, they are not homogeneous by nature. They are very diverse, mutually contradictory, each conflicting with the other. Because if the mind is absolutely calm and quiet, then what it means is this diversity of impressions is no more there. If we can divert all our mental energies, impressions and thought currents in one direction, then you feel a total concentration, absolute calmness and quietude. When this is done with our own willpower, with a sense of freedom, when we can, at our will, direct our mental forces in the direction in which we want to direct these mental energies, then mind is within our control. But remember, at that time, mind becomes non-mind. In fact, that's the subject towards which Patanjali is leading us. How to get away from mind? How to get out of mind? Or what is called meditation. So these thought currents and impressions, which are mutually contradictory, belong to two fundamental categories, not just two categories. They may belong to any number of categories. But generally speaking, they belong to two fundamental categories. One set of impressions and thought currents that support you, that help you. Another set that oppose you. If this contradiction did not exist, we can work as a machine. You know, a machine doesn't disobey you. But machine is not freedom. So you used to mention, we may be able to divert all our mental energies in the direction in which we want to divert, if you are terribly interested, but that interest is interest with slavery, not freedom. As I mentioned, people who get crazy about certain sports items, certain games, some sort of hobbies, they will have a tremendous power of concentration when they are focusing their attention on that particular area. But it is a slavery because they cannot take their mind away from that and divert into another channel, into another direction, if they want. So there is no freedom. When you can do this with freedom, then you are transcended mind. So one kind of interest where we can focus all our mental energies in one direction is a kind of obsession. The other one, freedom. A yogi or a spiritually elevated person can treat his mind or her mind as a slave. In the other case, the mind is the master and we are its slaves. So when we reach that state where we transcend mind, there is a particular term in yoga that is called Ritambara Prajna. Ritambara Prajna. Prajna. When you reach that state, then on the one hand, we will have complete control of our mind. There is perfect harmony and peace, which means you transcend mind or your mind becomes non-mind. You find how Patanjali leads us to that direction. So, but we have not reached that stage. So the samadhi without question, that is called nirvitarka. Vitarka here means questions. Some kind of, not totally or absolutely free. There is always some modification. So I was trying to read this system with Patanjali slokas, with the commentaries, and also with Swami Vivekananda's interpretation, which is modern. If you read Vyasa or Bhoja or Vijnana Bhikshu and others, you get the technical terms used. So very often there is a disconnect. So I thought I would read Swamiji's interpretation. So Swamiji, samadhi called without question comes when the memory is purified or devoid of qualities, expressing only the meaning of the meditated objects. So you find an evolution. From word you come to meaning. That is, word is a vibration, you come to the meaning, And then from meaning, you come to the essence of that meaning. So it is by the practice of meditation of these three that we come to the state where these three do not mix. What are these three? Sound, meaning, and resulting object, which get mixed up. Our normal understanding of anything in this world is a mixture of this sound, I mean the vibration, meaning, this nerve current which bring it to our system, and our own reaction, which is called our internalization of the information we are getting. That's how we respond to it. So our understanding, our interpretation, the way we look about things is our response to a phenomenon, an object. See, when we hear a sound coming from the street, the sound comes, sound waves comes, and it has a meaning. So the meaning is that it is coming from some kind of an automobile, and when we pursue, when we get a clear picture of the object from which the sound is coming, it is our response, it is our internalization of this stimuli, which is called knowledge. So now all knowledge is the way we respond to different things. So we will first try to understand what these three are. Here is the citta. Citta is the mental system. So citta should be understood either as a leg or as a bag. These are two ways of understanding our citta. So if you want to understand the citta as a character, as what constitutes, what determines our reactions and attitudes and behaviors, then, or our memories, then it can be looked upon as a bag, a mixed bag, a bag full of different memories and impressions. But if you look upon citta as accumulating memories, as a phenomenon, as something that accumulates memories, then it can be called a lake, like a lake. And the vibration, the sound, like a pulsation coming over it, you have that calm lake in you, and I pronounce the word cow, as soon as it enters through your ears, there is a wave produced near citta along with it, so that the wave represents the idea of a cow and form the meaning, if you call it. So I shall explain. Like look upon a lake, if something falls on that. That sound creates a vibration, a disturbance on the water surface. And then what happens? It remains there and it responds to that. Do you find when a stone falls on the surface of the water, you find there is a split, an impact. So there is an impact. Like that, when we hear the word cow, it's only a word, and we perceive it, or rather we try to understand it, then we get a meaning. And then when we associate that cow with something we have already seen earlier, it belongs to the particular GC category of animals, it has got certain characteristics, then it is knowledge. That's how we respond to it. Okay, then what happens? These impressions remain in the mental system. So, interestingly, the Buddhists have a very, very, very interesting way of analyzing this phenomenon. It is called Sautrantika school or Vijnanavada school of Buddhism. It is a kind of subjective idealism. You know what they believe? They say, you see this chair. The object connects with an impression in your mental system. So when you see an object, and when you understand an object, there is already there, the impression or memory of the object is already there in the Vijnanam. Vijnanam in the Vijnanavada school is a platform where all these remain. So when you see an object, and when you identify that object for what it is, these impressions, which are already there in accumulated in the vijnanam, is called vijnanavada. I mean, it's a kind of subjective idealism, where external things are totally unreal. That is the basic philosophy. External phenomena are totally unreal. They're all coming, but the real things are within. When you see an object through visual contact, and when you interpret and understand that object for what it is, you're connecting that object with these images or impressions or memories that are already accumulated in the mental system, which they call vijnana. So, in a way, that is true. You don't recognize anything unless you have something of it in you, within you. You can never fully understand anything which you are totally unfamiliar with. Not that you are familiar with everything that you know. There are many things that we didn't know about it. But unless you have something of it in the form of a memory, an impression within you, you won't be able to recognize it for what it is. You won't be able to understand it for what it is. So all these things exist in the vijnana, it's a kind of platform. That's what they say. So more or less, the yoga system of perception comes not very close, but somewhat close to that. That's what Swamiji is saying here. So when you internalize this knowledge, that internalization is nothing but your response to an object, and you understand this knowledge. Okay, now, the result of the reaction, and that is knowledge. So what is the result of reaction? How do we respond to this object like cow or chair or elephant or anything? When somebody speaks that word, it's just a word, a vibration as they call it. You know? In the yoga system, it's called a vibration. It's called tatra shabda artha jnanam. Shabda means word. Artha means what that word implies. Jnana means the way we understand it. Buddhists say this understanding is not possible unless you have all this in your system in the form of ideas. That's called a subjective idealism. So Vijnanavada is called a subjective idealism because already there are things which you, when you see an object, you connect that object with its idea counterpart, which is already there in your system. Oh, this is just one school of Buddhism, not all. There are many different schools of Buddhism. So this becomes a subject later. Now, next one is the next sutra. Etayaiva savichara nirvichara cha sukshma vishaya vyakhyada. So by these concentrations, we have already explained the process of meditation here. Now, we are coming to a very important subject here. Now, sukshma vishayatvam cha alinga paryavasanam. This is a very interesting sutra. Alinga here means prakriti. What Sankhya philosophers call prakriti or mula prakriti, what yoga is called prakriti. What is prakriti? I already mentioned earlier, the Patanjali system, it borrows its metaphysics from Sankhya philosophy. And Sankhya philosophy is built upon the foundation, the two concepts, twin concepts of evolution and involution. There is a gradual manifestation of the effect from the cause, which we call evolution. And then that cause, that effect going back to its cause is called involution. So it is not just a speculative system. This also is a foundation of Hindu cosmology and Hindu cosmogony. Because the basis of Hindu or Vedantic cosmology is this. Everything comes and goes back and comes again. In other words, the entire cosmos, existence, it evolves. It's called parinama. It evolves. It's evolution. It evolves from a kind of unmanifest, subtle entity. Through gradual process, everything evolves. The evolutionary process is very simple. At individual level, at the level of different objects, everything comes from Prakriti. First, Mahatattva, then Ahankara, the ego system. Mahatattva, let us say, it is the first evolute from Prakriti. The first evolute. So first you should remember, the Sankhya and Yoga philosophers, they believe in two fundamental categories. I don't have any this kind of modern, part presentation called picture which somebody, when we use this screen and all that. But it's very interesting. If you think of two fundamental categories, one is the conscious category, consciousness, awareness, knowledge. The other one is unconsciousness. Consciousness is called Purusha. It is, so our true nature is that we are Purusha. We are conscious. But when we identify ourselves with things which are unconscious by nature, then we interpret ourselves to be unconscious. So the unconscious entity is called Prakriti. It is called Jada. It is unconscious. The conscious entity is called Purusha. Evolution takes place from Prakriti. You may ask the question, how can evolution take place from something which is essentially unconscious? In fact, this was the strong foundation on which Shankaracharya demolished Sankhya metaphysics. The Sankhya and Yoga metaphysical conclusions are defective, but their analysis of human mind, their analysis of emotions, feelings, and attitudes, their analysis of our characteristics, tendencies, impressions, memories are absolutely fantastic. Very rational, very scientific. But their metaphysical conclusions are not accepted by Vedantins. So Vedantins accept the analysis part of Sankhyas and Yogas, but they reject the conclusions, and there is a strong reason, because it is essentially dualistic. So anyway, now coming to the subject, their explanation of how everything in this world evolves from Prakriti is absolutely logical. What they say, from this Jada Prakriti, first a Mahatattva, a kind of cosmic subtle entity, which has an element of awareness, evolves. From that Ahankara, Ahankara is the ego system. Ahankara has got three dimensions, Tamasika, Rajasika, and Sattvika. From Sattvika aspect, from finer, let us say, aspect of Ahankara, mind comes. From the other two, senses, etc. comes. So Buddhi is identified with Mahatattva. Now what they say is, from this Ahankara, a kind of subtle entities emerge. The subtle entity is called Tanmatras. So Tanmatras is nothing but the subtle causal forms of phenomenal world. Let us say, what is water? What is one of the Panchamahabhudas? But what constitutes water, its essential properties, which make water what it is called Tanmatra. Heat, for example, fire, like that, air. So all the Pancha Mahabhutas, they call, are emerging from Pancha Tanmatras. So the whole universe is constituted by these Pancha Mahabhutas, the gross elements, which emerge from Pancha Tanmatra, which is subtle elements. And our mind, our intelligence, our intellect, our ideas, our emotions are all related to Ahankaras. They all constitute different evolutes of Prakriti. Now, when you practice yoga, you know what happens. You're actually you are actually affecting a kind of counter evolution. You go back to the cause. So through meditation, you try to understand the cause of this external universe, tanmatras. And beyond tanmatras, you go to ego system. And beyond ego system, finally you reach mahatattva. Finally, you understand everything comes from prakriti. So this is with regard to the external phenomena. Now this is just one fraction of Sankhya principle of evolution. Well, it is something like this. If you have got a seed of a tree, that a tree may have thousands of fruits, one seed. But one seed potentially contains the whole tree actually. The tree pre-exists in the seed. If it did not exist in that seed, so you put, let us say, mango seed, from which you cannot get a coconut. So the whole mango, mighty mango tree is involved, it's called involution. It is involved in a subtle state in that seed. When you plant it, pour water, what happens when the conditions are favorable? The seed becomes sprouts and becomes a plant, it becomes a tree, and from which a number of trees. Seeds come, fruits come, which have tree, with the seeds. So every single seed involves, it involves that mighty tree which it grows into. So the tree pre-exists in seed. That's the principle. In other words, prakriti contains everything in this world. When a yogi meditates, you know what he first does? First he withdraws his mind and senses from all external panchamahabhudas. And then through meditative process, he takes upon a journey from effect to cause. Finally, he reaches prakriti. And then he realizes the prakriti is not his true nature. Purusha is true nature. When through false identification, Purusha identifies itself or himself with prakriti, then we think we are just this psychophysical mechanism. If you can interpret yourself just in terms of cells, bones, flesh and marrow, then we are not in any way different from a very intelligent animal. But the moment we recognize the presence of something which is alien to prakriti, which is essentially conscious, when we recognize that we are not an evolute of prakriti, which is essentially jada or inert, unconscious, we are actually consciousness itself. You are actually non-identifying yourself with this dead inert entity called the psychophysical mechanism. So in this body, in this mind, in this intellect, there is the presence of Purusha is there. But what happens, we forget that. So when we see an external thing, and when we get enamored of, obsessed by that, then we forget our consciousness. Our true wealth, our true identity, we forget. So we identify ourselves with this external universe. So a kind of dehypnotization, that's what Vivekananda calls it. A spiritual journey is a journey towards dehypnotization. We have self-hypnotized ourselves into thinking that we are not Atman, that we are this inner world. When people think life is meant for enjoyments, life has no other meaning. Life, the whole purpose of human life is just to enjoy and forget about it. Then what happens, it is kind of self-hypnotization. And according to Vivekananda, who is in modern times, he interpreted yoga, Sankhya and Vedanta for the first time. So you find him being very informal. I mean, it's a layman's interpretation, but absolutely authentic interpretation of these philosophical ideas. Long before Radhakrishnan and others wrote Indian philosophy, nobody in the West ever heard of Sankhya school of evolution before Vivekananda appeared here. So this with regard to the external phenomena. Now, I mentioned earlier, this is also the foundation of Hindu cosmology. Why? Because in Hindu tradition, the whole universe emerges out of one and manifests subtle, universal, whole entity. It is a whole cosmic entity. When the manifestation takes place, gradually this evolution begins, so this world comes into existence. So what is manifestation? Manifestation is nothing but this unmanifestate becoming manifest in terms of name and form. Nama, rupa, it's called. Nama is name, rupa is form. So when the other one is called the unmanifestate in Veda, in Sanskrit, it's called avyakta, unmanifestate. So when this manifestation, which means things appearing to be in to be names and forms, begins, evolution begins. So a spiritual seeker in Vedanta is actually trying to dehypnotize himself. It's got a reverse evolution, so to speak. And then he understands behind all this, there is that conscious reality, Atman. It's called reverse evolution. So, as I mentioned, Hindu cosmology, the universe, the manifest world, emerges from the unmanifest. And then at one point, maybe after trillions of years, you find in the Puranic literature it's called Brahma Shatantari Api, you know, which means, let us say, in mathematically, trillions or quadrillions of years, let us say, just a mythological concept. At one point, this created universe will go back to its unmanifest, subtle state, causal state, only to reemerge maybe after several trillions of years. Like that, this cyclic process goes on. It's called cyclicism in Hindu cosmology. It is just the opposite of the eternal progression theory that you find in, of course, that you find in the Abrahamic traditions, but I believe modern science comes closer to the Sankhya, Yoga, Vedanta concept of evolution, involution, and cyclicism doctrine, rather than the cutthroat creationism, which people may not take seriously these days. So modern science may be closer to cyclicism than creationism. This is my understanding. I mean, this is the view of many, many modern scientists also. Another interesting thing, Hindu cosmology says it is not creation, it is projection. So the word used in the mythological book called Sarga. Sarga is projection. So when the unmanifest projects itself as the manifest, in terms of names and forms, diversity in terms of names and forms, it is called evolution. And after trillions of years, it may go back to and manifest it. Well, some of you may remember about 10 years back, long before, a few years before I came to this country, I read an article in American Science Reporter, most probably. It was a very interesting article and highly futuristic. So it says, what will happen if all of a sudden everything collapses in Manhattan? It's a speculation. So it says after 2 years, if you look, you know, water, the water may flow, the streets may get diluted. And then after 10 years, small plants may start growing on what once used to be skyscrapers. After 500 years, after 1,000 years, so it goes on. Then what it would be like after 5,000 years? And finally, what it may look like after 5 million years? After 5 million years, the picture is like a gaseous form. So all the names and forms have practically vanished. And again, it may take several millennia, maybe thousands of, tens of thousands of years for the life to start again. And again, human intelligence may war and create cities where you divide everything. So it's a very interesting article, which I have lost trace of, maybe 10, 12 years back published. So what this city would look like maybe after a few millions of years? It may look like gases form. It may not. You can't see anything. You can't tell anything from anything else. So nama, rupa disappears, all merging to nama means names. Rupa means forms. So it is kind of involution. That's why Vedanta and Yoga and Sankhya philosophy says that there is no such thing as creation at all. What you call creation is nothing but projection. The unmanifest projecting as the manifests. When you look at the unmanifest through the prism of names and forms, you have this world. Once you get spiritually enlightened, then you can look, after removing these glasses of names and forms, you will see only the unmanifest. That's a Vedantic. If there is a evolution, there is a reverse evolution. So when a yogi meditates, the subject here, when you meditate, you know what happens? First you withdraw yama and niyama, because you should not go crazy, so you have to practice yama and niyama first. If you practice pranayama and all that without yama and niyama, everyone, people may go crazy. So mind should be in a steady condition for the yama and niyama. Then asana you need for sitting quite a long time, sira sukham asana. Then pranayama you need because to conserve energy, to generate heat and energy, which may be required for you to make, to continue your journey. And then pratyahara, that's the beginning. Pratyahara means you're trying to withdraw the mind from external objects. That's the beginning of reverse evolution. Because after evolution, the human system is so programmed that you look at external things. Paranjikhani vidurna soyambhu. That's a Kathopanishad says, human mechanism is so created, so programmed, that the senses are always projecting outward. Now, pratyahara means you are actually turning the senses inward. Pratyahara. Dharana means then you focus on something deeper within you. Dhyana means higher, long concentration. And samadhi means you have finished your reverse evolution. This idea behind. So even by living in this body, through spiritual practice, we can independently take up this journey of reverse evolution. That's what yoga actually is all about. And there is no God anywhere to be seen in this process. That's an interesting thing. But yoga and Vedanta, yoga and Sankhya, Vedanta of course accepts God. In the yoga Sankhya system, there are references to evolved souls, but there is no reference to a transcendental moral authority with certain qualities and characteristics, and of course a long list, which I am not referring to now. Now the subject comes. So now we are taking up this 45th sutra, Sukshma Vishayatam Cha Alinga Paryavasanam. You can see a word here, Alinga, which means Moola Prakriti. What is Moola Prakriti? The beginning, the source of our evolution is called Moola Prakriti. Prakriti means the original source from which everything evolves is Moola Prakriti. So, as you meditate through this process, the verse means the finer objects end with Prathana. Prathana is another word for Moola Prakriti, that's okay. So this, what it means is, this eventually takes you to Moola Prakriti. The gross objects are only elements and everything manufactured out of them. So what it means is, so Swamiji is here trying to, he is referring to the external phenomenal world constituted by gross objects. What are these gross objects? They are only elements, they are only outer manifestations of ends, they are the manifestations of subtler elements called tanmatras. So from finer objects, we finally reach this cosmic wholeness, cosmic entity. The fine objects begin with the tanmatras or fine articles. The organs, the mind, egoism, mind stuff, the cause of all manifestations, the equilibrium state of sattva, rajas, tama, all called pradhana prakriti. What it means is, from prakriti, mahatattva, the cosmic intelligence comes. From that, the ego system, in its higher, subtle, refined ego form, it becomes mind. In its less refined form, it becomes the senses of perception and senses of action. And then again, from that, tanmatras, the subtle elements, from subtle elements, gross elements, constituting the empirical phenomenal universe all comes. So in other words, yoga helps you to de-identify yourself with these evolutes, which are essentially different manifestations of prakriti. Because that's the real cause for most of our misunderstanding. Then 46th one is Ta Eva Sabija Samadhi. So this particular kind of meditation will you end up through reverse evolution, you identify your this entire universe with prakriti from which it evolves. That particular state of concentration or meditation is called Sabija Samadhi. Sabija means with seeds, endowed with seeds. What it means is when you reach that level of meditation, you certainly go beyond, you transcend, but then these seeds remain in subtle form in the mental system. They are not completely destroyed. That's the idea behind. These do not destroy the seeds of past actions, and this cannot give a liberation. But what they bring to the yogi is a state following aphorism. The next sutra, aphorism comes. What it means is, when you reach this kind of sabija samadhi, what happens is, the past actions are there, but they do not trouble you much. But their potency, the scope for troubling you, or interfering you, or coming to the surface of the mind and creating problems, may be still there. That's why people who suffer from past memories, you know, memories, unpleasant memories, which often torture their minds, when they move away from the immediate geographical regions or places which are associated with the unpleasant memories, they are able to gradually, of course, temporarily, not permanently, but temporarily, they are able to free themselves from the torture of unpleasant memories. Because memories are related to not only mind, but places, individuals. See, when you go to a place which has some association with an unpleasant memory in your life, which you don't want to remember, when you see the place can immediately can bring back those memories. Why? When you are away, memories are there, but they are not on the surface. When you go to that place, these memories come to the surface. So spiritual seekers who have not reached the highest Nirbija Samadhi, which is the highest, where the memories and impressions become like seeds which are fried. See, if you buy seeds and fry in oil and keep in the fridge, they are not going to sprout. But if you keep those seeds somewhere else, levy, then of course they can sprout, they can reach again. So, of course, the comparison stops there. because we are not talking about seeds as such. This is a comparison for want of better analogy. So what happens when you see a person, that also can, or when you think of the person, which again seeing mentally, if you listen to a sound or a music from the past, which you may have heard maybe 40, 50 years back, but with some unpleasant memories or impressions, then if you listen today, if you listen to the music, those memories will come back to the surface. So words can do that. You need not hear the word, or even if you remember those words or the music, there you are not hearing in a physical sense. Mentally you are hearing. That's what is called remembering. Remembering a word is nothing but reliving this hearing experience. Remembering a visual object is nothing but seeing again mentally at the mental level. So all these can bring back to the surface of the mind past memories. Because those seeds, they are there, but they, when you move away from that geographical locality, or from those persons, then of course you may not remember, you may not see them, hear them. But when you hear again, those things will come back. Similarly, every human being has got a number of good and bad memories. Memory is not a word. We call vrittis, vasanas, samskaras. That's what they call yoga system. Vasanas and samskaras are very powerful. Memories, there is always, when you remember, there is an element of awareness and consciousness about it. And to some extent, perhaps you can try to weaken. But samskaras and vasanas operate without our permission. They don't seek our permission. What we instinctively do, without any deliberation or planning, that actually reflects our samskaras. That's a real character. The memories are much weaker. But still, what happens is, memories which remain in seed form, but still not sprouting right now, could sprout some other time. That's why Vivekananda says, these do not destroy the seeds of past actions. This is Abhija Samadhi. And thus give liberation. But what they bring to the yogi is stated in the following aphorism. So we will deal with that later. We will discuss the subject later. We can ask questions if you are interested. Questions discussed.
Thank you, Swami. People seem to be hypnotized in different ways, and maybe it's the same way overall, but they're experiencing it in different ways. So I've noticed that some people, when you alert them to the potential to view their situation differently, some are very comforted. They say, oh, potential is there, very good. Others seem very concerned that it's a potential only and it isn't manifest in their lives yet.
Is potential wrong, eh? This is a long way, but it's a long way.
Yes, if they're concerned that the potential is a long way out, yes. Especially in terms of their...
I want to comment upon this distance view.
Yes.
Distance is only imagination. So, if we are sincere and focused, 1,000 miles can become an inch. If we are negligent, slow, whenever it comes, then it could be 10,000 miles. So, I can give an example. See, you find one interesting aspect of many great spiritual seekers. Once they decide to practice or meditate, they won't waste one split second. Once they decide, it's as good as starting doing that. So, Sri Ramakrishna, I tell you an example. If you read Sri Ramakrishna's life, you find whenever an idea came to him, he didn't stop one split second. Straight away, headlong, he went to that. Of course, we can't compare everyone with Sri Ramakrishna, but intensity can reduce the distance. Distance is our interpretation, actually. It is not physical. See, mental distance is more or less our creation. If we want, with intensity, we can reduce 1,000 miles into 1 inch. Not only that, those who are highly evolved, when you hear something, immediately it translates into some kind of an experience to you. People who are, in our Vedantic text, there are two different views about this distance. One view is, those who are highly evolved spiritually, very focused, if they just hear one word, immediately it connects with them. Well, in modern context, if you go to the university library and read a book, but if that's the first time you are connecting yourself with that idea, but rather, suppose you have been for a long time speculating, praying, meditating, and suddenly you find a university library, an idea, immediately connects. But if that's the first time you are hearing, it's still 1,000 miles. So it is called Shabda Parokshavada in Vedanta, which means for a highly evolved soul, once they hear a great statement, Vedic statement, it becomes a matter of experience. So when I was in India, in some philosophical conferences, I tried to explain this. It's called Shabda Parokshavada. When the teacher tells Tattva Masi, you are that absolute reality, immediately that Mahavakya, the statement, becomes, it translates into Aham Brahmasmi, I am the Brahman, as an experienced great spiritual seeker. So I used to give this example. Suppose you have got lost your passport or visa, important document here, and you are looking for it in the streets. You know it, you have lost it somewhere. You are going in search of it. If it lies there in the middle of the road, you won't wait one split second. It's my passport or not, or some other trash or something. You don't think for a moment. Immediately it connects with you. Why? Because you are in your mind, you are thinking, where is my passport? Where can I get it? It's a matter of maybe very serious thing. So whole mental system, all the vrittis are focused on this, the passport aspect. And when you see it, you catch it. Because your mind is ready. Your mind is freed of all other speculations and vrittis. Only this passport in your mind. When you see that, you take it. But suppose you're walking the street and you have not lost anything, you are not worried about anything, you find something, oh, what is that? What it could be? You may think a long time, 1,000 miles. But if it is your own thing, you're looking for it, one split second. So what is distance? Distance is a creation of our imagination. Sri Ramakrishna uses the word vyakulata. There is a very interesting word he uses. A person, a spiritual seeker who is focused on it, for him, distance is not distance. This idea.
So, Swami, starting from a dualistic perspective, from a Sankhya perspective, the ego, or ahankara, is a derivative of prakriti.
Yeah.
Then how do we explain our awareness of that ego? How do we connect Purusha to that?
Yeah. This Purusha element consciousness is there in us. But what happens, you know, when we see different objects, we identify ourselves with that object, which is an evolute of prakriti, which is inert. So what happens, this awareness element comes from the Purusha, which is essentially inherent in us, but we have forgotten it. We identify ourselves with the external objects. That's why I'm aware of it. That idea comes only for a person who are more little away from that low level of identification with the evolutes. People who completely identify with an external object. They don't think of themselves as something other than that person who connects with that object. Well, Swami Vivekananda, he said, there are very interesting flashes in complete works. He says, a dog eating a piece of meat, a hungry dog eating a piece of meat, it doesn't sit and think and enjoys. You find it won't raise his head from the piece of meat it's eating. It's engrossed in that. Okay, now, because it completely identifies with that. So human beings who have no thought of anything other than these fleeting sensual enjoyments, when they enjoy these things, there is complete identification. Normally educated, cultured people, refined people, when they eat food, they may be enjoying it, but they are capable of lifting their eyes away and looking around. But a dog doesn't do that, because hungry dog doesn't do that. The close identification with external things is stronger in people who are less evolved. So this may be the example is given there. You know, a hungry dog, when he eats a piece of meat, it doesn't speculate. It's engrossed in the act of eating and enjoying it. Human beings are there, of course, not very different, but still different levels, you know. So it's very interesting. But a refined, well-educated person will not do that. So that's an interesting. To what extent we lose ourselves in connecting with or enjoying or dealing with external sensual things, to that extent, we are less evolved. For others, these things are there, but they are also aware of something other than these material things. To that extent, they are more evolved.
Swamiji, I have one. So how the vasanas and samskaras are different from memories?
Oh yeah, vasanas and samskaras sometimes manifest as memories. Vasanas and samskaras are subtler than memories, but they manifest as memories. Of course, when you remember something, you are aware of it. Your mind goes back to what you remember. But samskaras and vasanas are sometimes instinctive actions. We are not aware of the fact that we have this samskara. We just act. When you meditate or when you think deeply of these things, then you'd be able to watch your own samskaras and be aware of your own samskaras. So that's why when a person takes a spiritual life like meditation, prayer, a secondary personality emerges. The secondary personality is a higher personality. A personality is within our own system, this secondary personality, which really wants to go ahead in spiritual path. The primary personality is, you know, it is controlled by the habits that we already formed, the practices we already formed. The secondary personality wants to break off these chains. And as you practice or think or meditate more and more, the secondary personality becomes stronger. It becomes aware of the samskaras and vasanas. But the primary personality is not aware of, because it identifies completely with samskaras. When you identify with something, you and what you identify with become the same. So you cannot be aware of it. And that's why, you know, what's the difference between a spiritual seeker? Well, I won't go that far. Not a spiritual seeker. Somebody who reads mystical books, spiritual books, higher philosophy. and an ordinary, and others who don't care. Those who read, at least intellectually, connect with higher ideas. Occasionally, they are able to turn the flashlight into their own system. When such people commit a mistake, oh, I made a mistake. That awareness, the ability to recognize a mistake or something that could have been avoided, that ability comes because a secondary personality is emerging higher than that. The secondary personality is looking. If the secondary personality is not there, you won't be able to throw the flashlight into your own system. So that's why any association, any discussion, any spiritual thing will always help us to help this emergence of a higher personality. And that higher personality will help you. Oh, maybe it was a mistake. I should not do it again. That doesn't occur unless you do something and try to help a secondary personality, higher personality emerge.
I have a quick question on the law of karma. So you mentioned that, you know, essentially everything is like Prakriti and Purusha, right? So which of the two is governed by the law of karma? So, I mean, if Prakriti is governed by law of karma and in reality we are Purusha, does that mean that we don't really fall into the cycle of law of karma?
Yeah. You know, I mentioned, please remember, I mentioned to you that the Sankhya conclusion is a bit, there's an element of logical fallacy in the Sankhya metaphysics. That's why Vedantins, which is a more whole, complete philosophy, accepts only those aspects of Sankhya and Yoga systems which deal with analysis of human mind, analysis of emotions, feelings, impressions, memories, and so on, which are very wonderful. In fact, so, now, coming to the subject, that's why even great Vedanta philosophers like Vivekananda and even Dr. Radhakrishnan, later on as an academic, they analyzed yoga, Sankhya systems only in the light of higher Vedanta. Otherwise, yoga, Sankhya system conclusions don't really make sense. It's okay. Now coming to the subject. The law of karma is not fatalism. Law of karma is pure logic, actually. In fact, modern science also is law of karma. What is law of karma? Law of karma means every effect has a cause. Nothing happens in vacuum. That's what law of karma says. It's a very logical analysis. It is not fatalism. It is not accidentalism, rather. Something happens by accident. Rather, law of karma is more logical than accidentalism. And certainly much more logical than fatalism. So, if your present law, present condition is the result of some actions in the past, then you can change. You can change and bring about a change in your destiny. In fact, a great Vedanta philosopher like Shankaracharya puts in a very interesting way. He says, the karmas responsible for our present conditions, this present embodiment, it's just like an arrow which has been shot by an archer. It has left the bow. It has not hit the target. But it need not hit the target. The arrow has to extinguish its velocity. If a strong wind blows, or another object comes in between the target and the arrow, then the arrow won't hit the target. Suppose you are destined by law of karma, if you believe that way. If you are destined for certain things, you can change it completely. That's what all the great teachers have said. Holy Mother says, Sharada Devi says, you may be destined to be bitten by a snake. You may be bitten by a small ant or a mosquito. So the intensity can be reduced. It's practically, that's why Shankaracharya says, if a strong wind blows, the arrow is deflected in another direction, need not hit the target. So law of karma has nothing to do with its popular misunderstanding. It is a very, very ridiculous misinterpretation of law of karma if you interpret it as fatalism. That's absurd. There is a school of fatalism in Indian philosophy. That is true. Fatalism is the kind of more similar, but not so like Calvin's, this kind of predetermination. Predeterminism was there in Indian philosophy, not in Vedanta, not even Sankhya and Yoga. So law of karma, very rational, logical analysis of what is going around now. This may be something behind it. So remove the cause, or reduce the intensity of the cause, the effect also will be modified. Okay, so next time. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.